The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world, and now the end of the war in sight. Disarmament ahead, lessening of tensions all over the world, troops come home. These are the headlines you wish you could hear. And you can in advance if you know where to look, because there exists a great master plan for peace. And truly the only good news that is available is in that great master plan that maps out the course of human trends in the years ahead. World leaders simply don't believe it. The average person feels those headlines are too good to be true. Incredible. And the news you hear today by the prognosticators and news analysts who try to view the last year's news and the year before that and walk on out into the future with tomorrow's world news, that news is pretty gloomy. But believe it or not, you can look beyond today's bad world news and see into the future clearly, and you can see through the future the great master plan for peace, the whole course of humankind laid bare before your eyes, the very best news possible. In a booklet on the subject, The World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. What is ahead for the world? This book that tells you peace at last is going to come. How total disarmament will be achieved. How there is a solution even to the population explosion. A solution to the growing drought and the threat of famine in India. A revolution in the weather, but this time for the better. Lessening of race tensions. One new calendar. One world language, one world religion, one world super government. Now, after all, these are our goals, you know. Maybe the average person hasn't thought about that. We tend to think of individual intermediate goals, more money, more time, more travel, more friends, more success, more physical pleasure. But if we would look at the great long-range goals, however we might phrase it, whether we would say an end to the war in Vietnam or a lessening of world tensions or peace, we still, if we were to analyze it, want solutions to all of these problems when we admit they are true and admit the monumental proportions to which they have grown. In the words of Sir Winston Churchill back in 1950, he said the creation of an authoritative, all-powerful world order is the ultimate aim toward which we must strive. Unless some effective world super-government can be brought quickly into action, the proposals for peace and human progress are dark and doubtful. And so say nearly all government leaders, as I've quoted in the past three or four broadcasts on this series of Just What Will the World Tomorrow Be Like? They say we need a world super-government, one world government. We tried it at the League of Nations and we failed. We tried to win the peace after we'd won the war and we have failed. We tried it with the United Nations. And now, world leaders disillusioned, give you only gloomy predictions about getting used to more and more catastrophes, more and more climaxes and chaos, more and more fear. Searching constantly for the answer, but convinced ahead of time we will never discover the real solution to the world's ills. They tell us this continually and constantly. Now, the synopsis of today's world news is all bad. Listen to the very best ideas that your world news analyst can come up with. This from one of the leading weekly news magazines in the Western world, an analysis of the outlook for the year ahead. The year 1967 is likely to be one of many frustrations and more than the normal number of disappointments, says the article. Now, what would you call your normal number of disappointments? That fateful telegram that tells you your boy or your sweetheart or your husband or your father has died in Vietnam, or that a loved one is lying on the hospital bed as a result of an automobile accident, or somebody else in the family with cancer, or someone else in a mental institution, or someone else with leukemia or muscular dystrophy or heart disease, or dead at age 46 of a heart attack or something like this. This is what people hear. These are our normal number of disappointments. In many parts, continues the article, of the world, the year 1967 is to be one of strain and uncertainty. War in Vietnam, says the article, will intensify. Red China worries both the United States and Russia. Antagonism of black Africa toward white-ruled Rhodesia and South Africa will grow. Famine once again is a threat in India, in spite of the fact that the United States has so depleted its reserves of wheat that now we have nowhere near so much present that we need in the case of a bad year ourselves, as has been pointed out. Pakistan's arms buildup is causing concern. Looking at specific areas, the analysis of the news went on. It talked first about Britain and how Britain during 1967 will be at grips with the toughest array of domestic problems it has faced in 20 years. First of all, Britain is in a time of rising unemployment and dwindling industrial investment. And then they cited the fear is that Britain may suffer severely if it becomes embroiled in an all-out economic war against Rhodesia and the neighboring Republic of South Africa. And incidentally, there is a $3 billion investment in that country on the part of Britain. Looking at Europe, news analysts say ties between the United States and Western Europe will continue to loosen. The Vietnam War, more than anything else, dramatizes a feeling among Europeans that their interests no longer are the same as those of the U.S., which is thought to be preoccupied with Asia. Looking at West Germany in particular, greater independence of action is ahead, they say, less reliance on leadership of the United States. This is to be expected from the Grand Coalition government of West Germany in 1967. This results, cited this article, from the resurgence of German nationalism. I'd like to add to that something the World Tomorrow program has been saying for more than 30 years. Watch Germany. Watch Mr. Strauss. Watch German nationalism and resurgence. Because believe it or not, it's destined to become one of the biggest concerns in your future years. Looking at Eastern Europe, this article went on, disputes among communist factions will grow, blocking communist unity. The enmity between Moscow and Beijing is getting hotter. Russia's satellites in Eastern Europe are showing more signs of wanting independence from Moscow. This unity, they said, will tend to grow this year on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Overall, this appears to be a year in which nationalism of every variety will show a strong rise. Now, that, incidentally, in spite of what Ulfant has said about individual nations giving up their nationalism, when he asked what element is lacking so that with all of our skill and our knowledge, we still find ourselves in the dark valley of discord and enmity, he said that in order to have a workable world government, each nation would have to come to the point where it's willing to give up its own ideas, ideals, and sovereignty, inasmuch as an individual inside of a nation must give up his own personal sovereignty, at least insofar as doing what he wants to do without regard to law and the consideration of the majority. Yet instead of national purpose dwindling, and instead of individual nations blending more and unifying more as if with single purpose and goal with the other nations of the world toward a common solution, today in this world the trend is greater and deeper nationalism, more individual sovereignty, disputes between neighbors, each nation creeping back into its own private nationalistic shell of its own language, culture, music, art, literature, religion, and government. In spite of the great coalitions and the great unions and the great attempts at this and that alliance, that's what the news says today. That more and more nationalism is going to be rampant in the world in the next year and on beyond. In the Middle East, they cited the danger of a big war and how this continues to exist. Fierce enmity between Israelis and the Arab countries keep tensions high. How Soviet Russia's covetous interest in the Middle East oil is another element. In Africa, the news magazine cited the fear of a shooting war in South Africa in 1967 and how this is growing, or at least in Southern Africa, not in the nation of South Africa, but in parts of Southern Africa. How there would be increasing pressure by Black Africa directed against Rhodesia and South Africa. How Nigeria may be torn completely apart by savage warfare among tribes. Troubles keep piling up in the Congo. No real solution is in sight. At any time in the next 12 months, went the article, the Congo could become once again a king-size headache for the world. But it's not just a headache in your newspaper that you don't enjoy your coffee with. It's something that is a deep tragedy for the peoples involved, and for the hapless humans who are being butchered, slaughtered, and murdered, as a tiny percentage of the world continues to convince itself it can enjoy a Disneyland push-button world of leisure and pleasure
and ask the rest of the world to die, to suffer poverty, misery, squalor, and war, and to starve quietly. In Asia, cited the article, Asian worries will continue to nag U.S. policymakers. Chronic food shortages in India are getting worse. Only food shipments from outside can stave off a full-scale famine by late spring of 1967. Pakistan, a big beneficiary of U.S. aid, now maintains ties with Red China and is starting a huge military buildup. And that's bad news for India. Isn't it amazing how U.S. aid goes pouring into so many countries which rarely, if ever, back U.S. policies, and when all is said and done, usually will turn to one of the communist bloc nations for help? The American policy of lavishing aid in this part of the world has largely failed to pay off, said the article. The question now, what can the United States do to help clear up the ugly problems that beset a huge area of South Asia? Now, most observers think that at least in Japan, there is a bright spot in the news. How Japan, said the analysis, will be moving more nimbly and confidently than ever toward a position of dominance in Asia. Plain Truth magazine articles have said that is not necessarily a bright spot, and you can watch for history to begin to repeat itself. Those who have ears to hear, let them hear and understand. And those who do not, well, I suppose that's their problem. Now, in China, the power struggle in Red China persists. More purges are likely this year, and all evidence available indicates that relations between Moscow and Beijing will get worse, said the prediction, walking out into 1967. Based upon past news, present trends, and what the future guesses might be, armed clashes along China's border with the Soviet Union would not be surprising, said this article. In Latin America, the only part of the world we haven't touched, alongside perhaps the North Pole and Antarctica, in much of Latin America, the present tendency of the military to exercise open political authority, as in Argentina and Brazil, will continue in 1967. President Johnson and other leaders of the hemisphere will meet in South America in mid-April, and not much is expected, however, said the article from that summit conference. Everywhere you look in news today, it's all bad. The morning news report on your radio program sounds like an obituary, with the death toll of last night and yesterday, the automobile crashes and the train and plane wrecks and the people burned to death and the murders and muggings and rapings and robberies. And you don't hear very much good news. But there is good news available, but you have to look a little further ahead than the next one or two or three or 5 years, just a little further ahead than that, but not much. You have to have a little more foresight than hindsight. Hindsight would tell you, based upon experience, that the present trends and conditions in this world are only destined to get worse. But there is a news source available that few people have ever tapped that goes right on out in the future beyond the 1967 and 1968 and 9. And tells you what to expect in the early and the mid-70s, in the early 80s. And that tells you there will be a lessening in tension in this world, that there will be a solution to drought and famine, the population explosion, the growing proliferation of atomic weaponry among the nations of this world, and that tells you solutions will be found, not in the way that you might expect, not from the source that you might expect. As that same magazine, the U.S. News and World Report, once phrased it, the only hope for the world today is a strong hand to intervene from someplace. This is what people admit. This book that tells you about that strong hand from someplace, whose hand it is and just where that place is and how it's going to come about. Now, to get an accurate measurement and a survey of this world the way it is, you have to look to all of the principal agencies of society, of government, and all facets of human life, the way it's being lived by people today. Where would you look? Well, you'd have to look, first of all, to education. The world is what its leaders have made it, and the world leaders are the educators of the world, the graduates of the big universities and the educational institutions of the world, and we're in the midst, incidentally, of an educational revolution today. You would have to look to society and the social trends. You would have to look to government, to science and technology, to commerce and industry, to all facets of society, to the social order, to religion. And you would have to carefully analyze each facet of life today and to find where have we come, how much progress have we made, and where are we headed. This booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, does exactly that.
It begins with science and technology and education and takes it apart, so to speak. Tells you at least how far we have come. Tells you how even those who are the fathers of the A and the H bomb have said that science, while it's able to put in the hands of military planners the weaponry with which to destroy all mankind, cannot control what science itself develops. In modern education, you find, with a shock, believe it or not, the perpetuation of false values, the teaching of distorted history, where historians behind closed doors admit they must be good party men, that they must shape this, discard that, pervert, warp and twist, or interpret something else, that they must be a good artist as well as merely a statistician reporting facts. You find warped psychology, perverted arts and science. Now, some of these things you want to stand back in the museums because you're afraid they might leap on you. You know, you're afraid they might grow on you, and so you don't want to stand too close because that's what might happen. Some of this junk and garbage that some people call art is not art, but the result of some kind of perverse, warped thinking of some type. It's a mixed-up, unhappy, and fearful world. You've got to admit that by any synopsis or analysis of news reports. A world divided against itself, filled with heartaches, frustrations, fears, worries, broken homes, juvenile violence and delinquency, divorce, crime, insanity, race hatred. You could go on and on and on, but why bother? You're familiar with it, and so am I. That's the kind of a world it is. And this decadent yet highly organized system of organized confusion is dying out. It's going to be replaced, as this booklet shows, by the right kind of educational system. Education should begin with the answering of the question, what is mankind? Where did man begin? What is human nature? Is there a God, and can you prove it? I mean, can you prove it logically? Now, for example, coming in the next number of the Plain Truth magazine is another one of these articles on questions evolution simply cannot answer. Questions that are unanswerable by evolutionists, and this deals with Archaeopteryx, and in case you haven't heard of him, Archaeopteryx means ancient wing. There was a bird, or was it a bird? There was something found in stratified rock along a shallow lake in Bavaria not so long ago, and this has been hailed as the greatest link between, mind you, lizards or reptiles and birds, because evolutionists claim that all of our modern birds, including the giant albatross and the tiny hummingbird, came from reptiles. Reptiles with their heavy, meaty, huge, bony structure, with their oozing pores and their slow, ungainly gait, with their unbelievably slow heartbeat and metabolism and their long span of life, as opposite from the little tiny birds with their rapid metabolism, fantastic heartbeat, with their little light, airy, air-pocketed, rather, bony structure and their eggshell-thin skull, eating their own weight like as not in the course of one day, living only by comparison, a few years to the large, huge lizards of the earth. You may not even know that science claims that anciently some slithering lizard reared his fetid head out of a slimy swamp and slithered ashore, and that over aeons of time he learned to climb trees, to run, to jump, to glide, to spring, to flutter, and finally to flop around through the air, and then even to fly backward. This article, coming in the next Plain Truth magazine, talks about the first fateful flight of Archie, the would-be Archaeopteryx, who wasn't quite, but tried to be. And it takes you back to the time when you might say in the bird kingdom, or the would-be bird kingdom, the birds were at about the same place in their development as mankind was when Orville and Wilbur were laboring in their bicycle shop. And it's just about as laughable, because all the so-called intermediate species, which are not even in the fossil record, which would be in the fossil record if Archie existed, but he didn't, and the whole thing is imaginary, but then isn't evolution imaginary anyhow? And here are pictures of exactly how the evolutionists feel, or guess, or assume birds developed from reptiles. They say there came a time when the first lizard looked around, and behold, there was a feather sprouting out of his elbow. Now, if you had a feather in your sternum or someplace, you'd probably pluck it out. We pluck hair. We even electrocute it. We smear goo on it and wipe it off. We shave it and shave it and keep on shaving it, but it keeps on growing back. And you would think it would have happened in reverse, that the more lizards found feathers, the more they would have bitten them off, plucked them out, and so on. Now,
This takes you through the whole imaginary story of how this first attempted flight after this lizard had dragged these feathers over rocks and in and out of dens in the rocks and caves and over logs and in and out of swamps and creeks and finally up into a thorn bush and then tried to flutter out of it. What would have practically happened to the first little would-be Archaeopteryx who tried to fly? Now, of course, the admissions of science are replete in the books and the articles and the journals on the subject about how Archaeopteryx was bowled over by merely a sharp gust of wind, and that's the whole reason they say that he was preserved. But if that is true, you will read in this article how his ancestors, who were nowhere near so equipped to fly as he was, would have been dying by the hundreds of thousands as they leapt off cliffs and tumbled out of trees. And you would have a veritable burial ground of fossil proof of intermediate species. Well, let the article show you. Because here are the artist's concepts and the pictures of Archie, and maybe even his aunt, Martha Opteryx, which means winged Martha. You'll read about her, too, and all of his relatives who had been having all kinds of dizzying headaches from jumping off cliffs. You know, the best ideas of evolution today about where you came from in the field of education? Scum, or soup, or slime. Now, the one theory, until really recently, until some scientists in St. Louis, it was, came up with a different idea, and they came up with an idea about a sort of a brown scum all over the earth. They say that proteins came before the amino acids, where other people say amino acids came before the proteins. So the question is, did you climb from slime, or did you come from scum? This is the question, to quote Shakespeare, that students learn in educational institutions today. Now, as a reporting on education, here is an article from Harper's Magazine not so long ago. It was an article in a major magazine entitled God in the Colleges. Here's what it said. Although the colleges pride themselves on the awakening of young minds and on the asking of the big questions of life, who and what is man? Whence has he come? Where is he going? Is there a God? It is soon clear, said the article, to college students that the big questions don't count, either in academic standing or in later life or in research grants. In the first place, the standing assumption is that ultimate questions are in principle unanswerable and hence not worth asking seriously. This assumption may not discourage freshmen, but over a four-year period, it's pretty well driven home. In the second place, nobody is much interested in students' answers to such questions or deems them worth putting in competition with anybody else's, said the article. Is education decadent? You bet it is. Did you ever see a prospective oil geologist busily studying his index fossil book to try to find out what's wrong with it? Did you ever see anybody admitting in an evolutionary geological session about the geologic succession, in this case of strata, that there is no one place on the face of this broad earth where the so-called geologic succession of strata exists? Did you ever see them admitting that you can find any so-called younger strata underneath any so-called younger stratum, I should say in the singular, or shuffled intermediately like a deck of cards? Did you ever see these admissions in textbooks on the subject? No, you didn't. You probably haven't. But you will see it gone into quite thoroughly if your name is on the mailing list of the world's unique magazine, The Plain Truth. There is no other magazine like it. No advertising in it. It's free of charge. A quality magazine that has even scooped some of the really big ones on news events, believe it or not, on some of the color news photography contained in the pages of that magazine. It's free of charge and no price. This highly organized system of education producing the government leaders of today deserves to be investigated. Because, after all, a tree is known by its fruit. And it's pretty simple to put two and two together and come up with four. And this world of absolute chaos is the result of the educated of the world and the policies, the principles, the precepts, and the goals of the educated minds of this highly organized society of ours. It's about time we began to admit it and to ask, how did it get this way? Now, when you look at science and technology, what do you see? The average human thinks that science and technology is his messiah, that is going to deliver him from poverty, from superstition, ignorance, disease, and unhappiness, and solve all of his problems. He thinks that if he can stick around long enough, he'll even have plastic organs to replace his own, and maybe even Additional longevity of life by the early 70s is being promised to humankind by science, and maybe finally, if he's a little dumb on one subject or the other, he can plug in his brains to a computer and have automatic memory cells that will store knowledge for him. Science and technology teaming up with commerce and industry are promising people a glittering glamour world of pleasure and ease by about 1975. But science has not been able to tell you the purpose of life. Science hasn't been able to tell you what you are and why you are. And to this day, preachers of funerals are standing around saying death is a mystery and telling you maybe he's one place or the other, and I've never even seen a graveyard for people who go to the other place. I don't care how rotten and evil and warped and distorted and twisted and perverted a man might be in his life, he gets preached into the never-never land of ether and hearts and wings and angels, at least as far as I can tell. I've never been to a funeral yet where a man was preached into that other place. Science still doesn't know what death is. It can't tell you really what life is. It can only tell you that there's a tremendous gulf between the two. Modern science has utterly failed to reveal to mankind the purpose of human life, the goal in human living, the meaning of life, the true values of life. What are the right goals of life? What should be achieved by a human being? Science doesn't know the way to peace, can't tell government leaders the way to peace. Yet the average person stands in awe of science. He thinks science is a sort of a god or a messiah that's going to deliver him from all of his ills. He's got his knees, he turns to science to solve it. You take a look at some of the claims of advertisements on the subject. Now, when you have a cold, here's what happens. You've got swellings in all kinds of compartments that you possibly had diagrammed for you that you never even knew existed. All through your head, looks like you got all kinds of pockets there called sinuses. They tell you where they are, and you get real stuffy. Now, you get a sore throat, you get a fever, you get a stuffed-up nose and head. Now, they claim, and it's a sure thing, that science has not found a cure for the common cold. Yet, most of the various cold drugs, and there are more pills and syrups and what have you for colds than any other illness known to mankind. And what they do is, they take away your headache, they reduce the swelling, they remove your fever, they take away the aches and pains, and really, when you do all that for somebody with a cold, what do you got left? Nothing. You're completely cured. Now, while they claim they don't cure a cold, yet it does sound to me like it cures a cold. People expect science to deliver them from their fears and worries and unhappinesses, and they treat science as if it were a sort of a messiah. But when you look at the product of science, and you look at the fruit of science, at what has been produced by it, you have to say that the fruits of modern science and technology have not been good. Well, this booklet on the wonderful world tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, tells you the outcome and tells you there is good news ahead and plenty of it, because it dares to admit the way the world is today, but then walk right on into the 70s and 80s and show you what it will be like. Write for it by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's the wonderful world tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. And also the Plain Truth Magazine, they're free of charge, no price. Write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time in this short series on the wonderful world tomorrow, What Will It Be Like? This is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard the world tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.